Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. I'm Mason Wilrich, your chair for today's program. And I will be joined by Dr. Jalay Dai, managing partner of Aurora Equity and a member of the Commonwealth Board, who will moderate the program following Dr. Kinzer's remarks. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Stephen Kinzer is an award-winning foreign correspondent who has covered more than 50 countries in five continents. The Washington Post places him among the best in popular foreign policy storytelling. As a journalist, he has served with the New York Times as bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua. While covering world events, he's been shot at, jailed, beaten by police, tear gassed, and bombed from the air. As an author, Mr. Kinzer's previous books include Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua, Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror, and Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Currently, Mr. Kinzer is professor on the faculty at Boston University, which is also his alma mater, and he's a regular contributor to Global Post. And lastly, having recently returned from a two-week adventure with him in Iran as a member of an outstanding study tour arranged by the Commonwealth Club of California, I can personally attest to the fact that he is, among his other talents, an over-the-top tour leader. Stephen Kinzer is here to discuss with us with his just-published book, Reset Iran, Turkey, and America's Future in the Middle East, which Andrew Bacevich calls, quote, history with bite and immediacy, and Thomas Pickering calls an informative read for experts and newcomers alike. And yesterday, I'm sure in this audience, many of us heard Fareed Zakaria announced Reset as his book of the week on his GPS show for CNN. So with that, Stephen Kinzer, it's a pleasure to introduce you to the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thank you, Mason. Thank you all for being here. I especially appreciate the promotion to doctor. It's a lot easier to do it that way than to do all that studying. I actually got an honorary degree from a university about a year ago, and when I came home, my wife, who's European, said that in Europe, this does entitle you to become called doctor for the rest of your life. She's, however, adjusted to American life and told me that doesn't work here. And I was a little disappointed. Well, we finally struck a compromise, and it was that I'd be allowed to be addressed as Dr. Kinzer for 24 hours after receiving the degree. So that was a great 24 hours, and this is the first reminder I've had of that moment. It feels good. It's actually not a new feeling for me to be a kind of an outsider. In the academic world, I'm not Dr. Kinzer because I don't have a doctorate. In Washington, I'm an outsider of a different sort. I'm the kind of person who sometimes has opinions or makes comments that lead others to think, you'll never be invited to eat lunch in this town again. Since I don't live in that town, I'm able to put up with that. Every time I go to Washington, which is as rarely as possible, I am struck by how narrow is the range of acceptable political opinions. Everything has to fit within this pre-existing paradigm, and the germ of any original commentary or out-of-the-box thinking is treated as the beginning of a terrible plague that needs to be stamped out immediately before it infects everybody. So it's nice to be outside the Beltway and in the real world where ideas are not so deeply held. Our project in the Middle East is really a project aimed at resolving problems that don't exist anymore. We've got a nice policy for the Cold War, but the Cold War is over, and we have not managed to change our policies. This trip that I made to Iran recently was fascinating, and it was made that way largely by the wonderful group of people from the Commonwealth Club who came with me. Some of them are sitting right here in the front couple of rows, and we're a special little band of brothers and headscarfed sisters at this point. I had been to Iran several times before. One of the things that started me off on my long-term fascination with this very interesting country is that whenever I get to any country, particularly a new country that I haven't visited before, I often find myself wondering, how did this country get this way? So why is this country rich and powerful? Why is this country poor and miserable? What happened? When I first got to Iran, I immediately noticed this disconnect. So here's a society that is very old, a culture with 25 centuries of history. That was the first real empire in world history that has produced these great leaders like Cyrus and Xerxes and Darius. But yet, Iran today is isolated and frustrated and unable to take its place in the world. Its people are unable to fulfill themselves and their lives. Why is this? Why did this disconnect develop? I started asking people in Iran this question when I first went there more than 10 years ago. I started reading about Iran, and the more I talked to people and the more I read, the more I realized that actually there was a moment when things started going wrong for Iran. Iran developed a thriving democracy in the middle of the 20th century. Many of you remember the name of Mohammad Mossadegh, who was the prime minister of Iran in the early 50s. At that time, it seemed like Iran was on the way to consolidating itself as a thriving democracy. Unfortunately, because Iran was a democracy, its leaders had to reflect the great desires of its people. And the people of Iran wanted two things at that point, at the period after World War II. Number one was democracy. That meant that the Shah should just be a figurehead like the Queen of England, and elected leaders should run the country. And the second thing Iranians wanted was nationalism, which to them meant we've got to take back our oil. Under a corrupt deal that had been struck at the beginning of the 20th century, Britain owned all the oil in Iran. No one else had any right to drill for it or refine it or extract it or sell it. So it was this democratic regime that came to power in the period after World War II that promoted these two great goals. Now, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which held the monopoly on Iranian oil, was at that time the most lucrative British property anywhere in the world. The entire British standard of living, all during the 1920s and 30s and 40s, was based on oil from Iran. All the jeeps and trucks and buses in Britain were running on Iranian oil. The factories in Britain were running on oil from Iran. And the Royal Navy, which projected British power all over the world, was run 100% on oil from Iran. When the Iranians announced their decision, endorsed by a unanimous vote in both houses of parliament to nationalize the British oil company, this set off shockwaves, of course, in Britain. The British thought of this as perhaps some kind of an absurd joke. At the beginning, they couldn't even grasp it. They couldn't take it seriously. Never had a poor country that controlled such a valuable resource insisted so forcefully on controlling that resource and not allowing foreign companies to exploit it. The British went through a whole series of steps to try to change Iran's mind. Those were unsuccessful. Finally, the British turned to their friends in Washington. And they persuaded, without much difficulty, President Eisenhower and especially his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, to organize a coup and overthrow Mossadegh. In a period of just 3 weeks in the summer of 1953, that overthrow was accomplished. That not only ended the Mossadegh regime, but it ended democracy in Iran. Had it not been for that coup, Iran might have spent these last 50 years as a thriving democracy in the heart of the Muslim Middle East. And I can hardly wrap my mind around how different the Middle East might be today if there had been this example of one of the big Muslim countries right in the center of that region embracing the principles of democracy. But unfortunately, the titans of democracy in the world, Britain and the United States, could not accept that. Because in Iran, democracy meant challenging not just the ownership of oil by Britain, but the whole system by which the world had been run for so long, that rich countries decided what resources they needed, how much they needed, and how much they were willing to pay for it, and imposed those conditions on other countries. So Iran was really in the vanguard of this movement of trying to take back control of resources. In my book, I suggest that Turkey and Iran are interesting potential partners for the United States over the 21st century. When I look at Turkey and Iran, there are some very intriguing similarities. One of the most important is that they have very democratic societies. Iran has not managed to have a government as democratic as its society, but in many ways, as I saw in this recent trip, Iranian society is even more democratic than Turkish society. If somehow you could peel back the layer of that religious regime, you'd find a country that's maybe even more democratic than Turkey, which we now describe as the most democratic country in the Muslim world. Why was Turkey able to consolidate its democracy, which it started developing 100 years ago? And Iran, which also started developing its democracy 100 years ago, has had so much more trouble. Well, there are a variety of reasons. But I think one of the big ones is the one I just talked about, which is oil. Sometimes you hear this phrase that a country is blessed with resources. I always worry when I hear that phrase because sometimes I think resources can be a curse. Turkey had nothing that the world wanted to steal. Iran had a lot the world wanted to steal. Iran had resources that attract the vultures. The vultures were not so attracted to Turkey. Just the last few days, we've been reading these new reports from Afghanistan that saying that Afghanistan has now been discovered to have trillions of dollars worth of minerals underneath its soil. When I read that, I thought, Afghanistan is finished. This is really the end. I mean, as bad as everything has been that's happened in Afghanistan over the last 30 years, this is the last nail in the coffin. Whenever you discover rich resources in a country that does not have a strongly established domestic political system, where foreign power is used to doing what it wants, and where warlords and the power of the gun rule, you have a recipe for terrible chaos. So I couldn't imagine up until I read this report how things could get worse in Afghanistan. Now I find out they're rich in resources. This is really, really bad. And there's no one in the world who can tell you how bad it is more poignantly than an Iranian. Now, our policy toward the Middle East is stuck in the past. We're very short-term oriented, which is why we thought it would be a great idea to overthrow Mossadegh. We got what we wanted in the short run. It seemed like a great success. We got rid of a guy we didn't like. We put in a guy, the Shah, who would do everything we wanted. So it seemed like the perfect solution. Well, in the long run, it hasn't worked out that way. The Shah, who we placed back in power, ruled with increasing repression for 25 years. His repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, the Islamic Revolution that brought us this fiercely anti-American regime in Tehran. That revolution also terrified the Soviets. It's what led them in part to invade Afghanistan to prevent revolutions like that from happening on their southern flank. That brought the U.S. into Afghanistan and helped create the situation we now face there. That revolution in Iran in 1979 also led Saddam Hussein in next door Iraq to decide this would be a great time to invade Iran. We Americans were so angry at Iran at that time, we became the military allies of Saddam. That began our death embrace with him that spiraled us down into the situation we now face in Iraq. So I think it's fair to say that a lot of unintended history came out of those few weeks in Tehran in the summer of 1953. Our short-term view of history has often come back to haunt us. And that's what I think we need to get out of as we look toward the 21st century. The crisis in the Middle East is not like one of those frozen crises like, let's say, Cyprus or Nagorno-Karabakh, where we'd like to solve it, but if we don't, nothing terrible is going to happen next year any worse than what happened last year. This crisis in the Middle East is intensifying. The hatreds and passions that are growing in that part of the world are deeply threatening. And not only has the strategic environment in that part of the world changed in ways that produce new threats to us and the outside world, but they also it also produces new, very intriguing opportunities for us. But we're not able to take advantage of them because our policy is still stuck in the old days. We have this, as I said at the beginning, very narrow paradigm. That great line from Dorothy Parker is very appropriate. When she was once asked what she thought of Katharine Hepburn's acting style, she said about Katharine Hepburn, she runs the gamut of emotion from A to B. That's something like our foreign policy in the Middle East. And one of the, actually another quote that stuck in my mind was one that my daughter brought home from high school one day. She told me that she had read this description by Albert Einstein of what is insanity. Insanity was defined by Einstein as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. That's what we're doing in the Middle East. So what would be a better idea? What would be a new approach? Well, I start from this principle that I think this is pretty widely accepted, even in Washington now, that our old policies don't work, that we need some kind of a big idea. Now, what would that idea be? I know it's there are some people that don't want new ideas to get out there and try to speak over us every time we try to introduce one.
It's a conspiracy.
But we insist. We're going to beat our spoon on the high chair until all the static is faded away. I start from the principle that America needs partners in that part of the world. You know, we have this idea that we get the Middle East. See, other countries don't get it. We understand what's happening there and what needs to be done. Other countries have very confused and mistaken ideas, including countries that live over there. They don't understand what's happening there as clearly as we do. I'd like to see us transition out of this view to a view where we want to take some advice. And actually, the country that has been most eagerly offering us advice in that part of the world is our longtime military ally, Turkey. Turkey is, of course, a member of NATO. Turkey has been our partner for decades. Turkey is the most democratic country in the Middle East. It has a democratic society, a democratic government, a thriving economy, which is predicted this year to grow at a higher rate than any economy in Europe. And the Turks do have a little advice for us. Their advice essentially could be boiled down to this. Look, we're on your side. We agree with you. We want to help you achieve your goals in the Middle East because they're our goals too. But we'd like you to think about whether you want to adjust your tactics here. Maybe you'd like to be a little less confrontational and try to deal with some of the problems in this region through diplomacy and negotiation. And we can help you do that. That's our advice for the United States. Unfortunately, the United States is not in the advice-taking mode. We're not good, actually, at taking advice. We're really good at giving advice. But we've often got into this feeling that since we know all the answers, it's really a waste of everybody's time for us to sit down and listen to what everybody else has to say. This, I think, lies behind some of the friction you've been reading about between Turkey and the U.S. in recent weeks. Part of it had to do with the effort by Turkey and Brazil to strike a deal with Iran over the nuclear program. Part of it had to do with the Gaza flotilla, which was planned in Turkey. But I think there's something that's bigger behind those episodes, and that is a kind of a new strategic or psychological disconnect between the Turks and their American friends. The Turks are saying, look, the 21st century is going to be the century of the middle powers. It's going to be the country when there's not going to be one or two big powers that rule. In the 21st century, Turkey is going to be important, along with Mexico and Brazil and Russia and India and South Africa. We are the future of the 21st century. The Americans are still trying to hold on to the old paradigm before any new powers began to rise. That was when we ruled. Naturally, we're more comfortable there. So I think here's the disconnect. The Turks are trying to push the curve of history a little fast, and the Americans are desperately trying to hold on to the old paradigm. So I would like to see the U.S. begin to take advice from Turkey on how to approach that part of the world. Turkey is a great model for us. What we would really like for the ordinary person in Iran, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco to answer when he thinks what kind of a country I'd like to live in the future would be, I'd like to live in a country like Turkey. Turkey has an open society and a booming economy. We should do everything we can to try to promote its example and hope that other Muslim countries follow it. Actually, when Turkey's off the American reservation a little bit and seems to be doing things that are not exactly what the U.S. wants it to do, that's actually good for us because it gives Turkey the credibility to project itself as an independent thinker in the Middle East. So we shouldn't be too panicky about Turkey not simply doing everything that we want every time we ask immediately. Turkey did try to make this engagement with Iran. That was their first effort. I think when the Turks and Brazilians arranged this fuel swap deal with Iran, they thought they were doing America a great favor. They thought they had taken some of the air out of this terrifying escalating confrontation over the nuclear program. Instead, the Americans slapped them down and said something like, we don't want a way out. We're on the sanctions option. We don't want to compromise with Iran. I think this was quite surprising to many people in Turkey and the Middle East. What struck me as particularly distressing was not just that we chose to see the glass as fully empty instead of possibly half full, but that we seem to give the message that sanctions and confrontation are the way we're going to try to deal with Iran and all countries by extension that we don't like. Actually, there is a tremendous emotional appeal to that option. And I'm not against sanctions as a matter of general moral principle, but I have to ask myself, what is the end game here? What are we expecting to achieve? If people really believe sanctions are going to make Iran get down on its knees and say, oh, we surrender, we give up our nuclear program, well, that would be a good reason to impose them. But nobody believes that's going to happen. Even the people that are in favor of sanctions are not telling you that they're going to have the effect that we want. This leads me to think that actually, they're a subset of the war option. They're not part of the peaceful option. In a way, I fear that what's going to happen is that since everyone knows they're going to fail, when they do fail, we will say, well, we tried everything. We tried all peaceful means, including sanctions. They didn't work. So we have no choice but to go to the war option and bomb Iran. So I'm troubled by that sanctions option. So the Iranians are definitely prickly negotiating partners for us. Nonetheless, the crisis there is growing, and it's worthwhile for us to listen to other options. I believe that it's not realistic to approach Iran with the demand we're making now, and that is you've got to negotiate with us on your nuclear program and accept restrictions on that program. I think it's possible that Iran might agree to make changes and to restrict its nuclear program in exchange for other concessions. But you cannot expect Iran to give up
what is essentially the highest card in its diplomatic hand, only in exchange for then being promised the chance to come into a room and talk to us about other things. If we approach Iran with a larger deal and say to Iran, look, we have a lot of complaints about you and what you do in the world, but we know you also have complaints about us. So let's make a list of all of these, and then we'll negotiate on all of them. That's the way we began our breakthrough with China. But of course, you only do that if you want a breakthrough. For a long time, I was asking myself, why is it that American policymakers don't grasp the fact that if we could somehow make an arrangement, an agreement, a deal with Iran, Iran could emerge as a calm, peaceful, self-confident, prosperous, democratic nation in the heart of the Muslim Middle East? Why don't they see that? Slowly, I began to wonder. Maybe the problem is that they do see it. And the idea that Iran would be a powerful and prosperous, self-confident nation in the Middle East is not appealing to the American foreign policy establishment. Nonetheless, we're certainly not progressing towards that goal. In an odd way, I see Israel and Iran, in one sense, in a somewhat comparable position right now. These are two countries, a lot of whose neighbors don't like or trust them, and a lot of countries in the world don't like or trust Iran and or Israel. There's a lot of anti-Israel emotion and anti-Iran emotion coursing around the world right now. People don't want to punish one or both of those countries. But emotion is always the enemy of wise policymaking. Leave your emotions outside the room and realize that Iran and Israel are powerful forces in the Middle East. No new security architecture in the Middle East can possibly succeed over their opposition. Therefore, it's not a good idea to punish them and sanction them and denounce them and force them into corners and making them feel alone and friendless. The world should be eager to try to coax them out of their isolation. And I think this applies to Iran just as it applies to Israel. Emotion is going to drive us to do things that in the long run are bad for us. And there's nowhere where this is more true than in the Middle East. Now, if we could work with Iran and work with Turkey, what would be the benefits of that? Why are these logical partners for the U.S. in the future? I think when you're looking for partners, you're looking for countries that have two qualifications. They should fit two criteria. First of all, they should be countries whose societies are something like yours. This is why, for example, Saudi Arabia makes a very puzzling ally for the U.S. There is nothing in common between that society and our society. Turkey and Iran are the two countries in the Muslim Middle East whose societies are very much like ours. The other thing we need is partners whose long-term strategic goals are comparable to ours. Now, to try to sell the idea that Turkey and the U.S. have similar long-term goals is not so difficult. After all, we've been military partners for many years. Trying to sell Iran as a potential partner of the U.S. is a little bit harder because it seems counter-instinctual after everything we've been reading in the press. But again, when you leave your emotions outside the room and forget about how angry we're supposed to be with Iran because of things they've done in the past, you can see that Iran and the U.S. have many important strategic interests in common, and these are interests that transcend regimes. They remain. They're interests of the state. Iran has a great ability to stabilize Iraq. Iran was the place where many of those Iraqi leaders lived for many years. Iran is the Shiite motherland. Iraq is, of course, a big Shiite country. If Iran wants to, Iran can even be our ticket out of Iraq, because our big fear in leaving Iraq is that it will explode in another round of horrible violence as soon as we leave. Iran, working with Turkey, can make pretty sure that won't happen. And getting out of Iraq soon and peacefully should be one of our key strategic goals. Iran can play a big role in helping us do that. Iran has a great ability to help stabilize Afghanistan. A lot of Afghanistan was in Iran For many years, up until Iran lost a few wars in the 19th century, Iran is very deeply rooted in what's now Afghanistan. Iran is eager to see the free flow of oil from the Persian Gulf to the West. Iran is the bitter enemy of radical Sunni movements like Taliban and Al-Qaeda, whose leaders want to kill every Shiite. So in the long run, Iran actually has the ability to be a partner power for the United States. Not only are these two countries not destined to be enemies forever, but they actually have a great deal in common. So my view is that we need to start anew and look at that part of the world fresh. Let's break out of that trap. Let's step out of the quicksand into which our Middle East policy has fallen. We look at that part of the world and see a host of terrors. And there are many terrors for us there. But there are many opportunities for us. The picture there is not entirely bleak as long as we take advantage of the opportunities that are available to us. Or as Rumi wrote back in the 13th century, why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Thank you.
Our thanks to Stephen Kinzer, journalist, former New York Times correspondent, and author of the new book, Reset: Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. I'm Jale Dai, and I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. And I'll be having the honor of moderating today's question and answer session. We have a number of questions, so let's begin. Stephen, why do you think Ayatollah Kashani decided not to support Mossadegh anymore? We are going back to the 1950s and the CIA-sponsored coup d'etat.
This is a little bit of a detailed question, but it has a fascinating footnote. So Ayatollah Kashani was a supporter of Mossadegh and the oil nationalization project. It was really a remarkable situation in which religious leaders were supporting a nationalist change. That doesn't always happen. At the end of the Mossadegh period, however, Ayatollah Kashani changed his mind, and he participated in the coup against Mossadegh in 1953. And Kermit Roosevelt, the American CIA operative who organized that coup, sent him $10,000 the day before the coup to enlist his support. I think the reason was simply that it may have been a desire for $10,000, but I think there was probably something else going on there. Kashani was a great predecessor of the Khomeini idea, and Kashani saw that Mossadegh was a secular liberal who did not believe in religious power. And I think Kashani's ultimate conclusion was, it's not good for us religious fundamentalists to be promoting projects that are only going to entrench secular democracy in this country. Now, interestingly enough, I have to finish with this little observation. So my book about the 1953 coup in Iran, All the Shah's Men, has been translated into many languages, and one of them is Farsi, the Persian language. Now, over there, Iran is not a party to world copyright conventions, so this allows them just to steal your book, Abby Hoffman's dream, and they can then translate it, and they make all the money, and if you're lucky, you might find out they've done it, but you're certainly not going to get a check from anyone. Sure enough, my book has been pirated and published in three different versions in Persian. However, I've been told from my friends over there that there's one change in the book. It turns out that Ayatollah Kashani's son is now a very big figure in Iran. He's actually one of the Friday prayer leaders and a big supporter of the regime. So he cannot be seen as being the son of somebody who took $10,000 from the CIA to overthrow an Iranian government. Therefore, the translations have been changed. And Ayatollah Kashani is now presented not as a participant in the coup, but as one of the victims. And I have met people in Iran who will tell me from reading my own book that the coup was against Ayatollah Kashani and also a little bit against Mossadegh. So you can see the power that you have when you're the person that buys the printing ink.
Very interesting. you've been in this business for a number of years.
Despite my youthful appearance.
Yes. Yeah. The question is, having been through all these countries and looking at American foreign policy towards these countries, have you changed your politics from your youthful days?
So I remember this line, wasn't it, that any man who's not a communist when he's 20 should be shot, and any person who's still a communist when he's 40 should also be shot? I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. I'll tell you one thing. Traveling around the world is terrible if you want to maintain your prejudices. There's nothing like reality to destroy your grand schemas. I set out to my first time when I was covering People's Revolution, believing that the peasant masses would lead the world towards revolution. Unfortunately, I discovered that there's no one in the world more conservative or more reactionary than a peasant who only wants a tiny little piece of land, even if it's only as big as a postage stamp, and he doesn't want to join a cooperative. That's only what us intellectuals think that peasants want or should want. So have I changed my view? I tell you what I think I have changed as a result of having been in so many different parts of the world, and it's that I've come to conclude that although I've worked hard to understand certain countries and certain episodes, there is a limit to how much you can understand when you start treating countries and episodes in isolation. Mm-hmm. The real understanding of how the world works and how America works in the world comes when you try to look from a higher perspective and see what ties all these elements and all these countries and all these episodes together. You know, I wrote a book about the overthrow of Mossadegh by the CIA in 1953. I also wrote another book called Bitter Fruit about the overthrow of the Guatemalan government in 1954. In both of these cases, I thought, oh, man, you really told the whole story. Congratulations, you ripped away the veil of lies and you told the truth the way it really was. Well, as often happens when you become a little self-satisfied, I came to realize that actually I hadn't told the whole story. Because no matter how much you know about one episode, like how the U.S. overthrew Mossadegh or what the U.S. did in Guatemala, you're not really learning the lessons until you can put all of these episodes together into a continuum and see them as one long period in which there are patterns that reemerge time and time again. Once you begin to see those patterns, then I think the world becomes a little clearer.
Okay, the next question is related to your point in the book regarding an imposed peace settlement between Israel and Palestine. Now, given the politics, American politics, and our system of elections, it seems to many of us that would be political suicide. Now, but let's for a minute assume that a courageous president would want to do that. The most likely scenario would be that he or she would do it at the last year of a second term. So given that, if we assume that, we have 4 or 5 years if President Obama is reelected. So what do we do in the next 4 or 5 years then?
The Israel-Palestine question has become, for better or worse, the world's crisis. It's not confined to that part of the world anymore. It's affecting the whole world, as we're seeing quite vividly ourselves. It's not possible for us indefinitely to say, well, that crisis is just somewhere far away and we don't have to deal with it. It is intensifying, and it is intensifying looming threats to the whole world. What makes this crisis so different from so many other crises in the world is that everybody knows what the end solution is going to be. That's been clear for decades, ever since the resolutions of the UN in 1967. We know there are going to be two states. Most of the Israeli settlements will be withdrawn from the West Bank. Jerusalem will be somehow shared. There'll be some kind of a land swap, and there'll be a limited right of return. All of this has been clear to everybody for a long time, but we just can't get there. And part of the reason we can't is that internal Israeli society, as well as internal Palestinian society, has too many elements that make it difficult to get past deep obstacles that are psychological as well as political. I think that neither side in this conflict is ready to stop fighting yet. And that's usually when conflicts end. These people are ready to go on fighting for another 60 years. And that's not good for the outside world. I don't see how any Israeli prime minister, and probably would be difficult also for any Palestinian leader, to make those major compromises that both sides will have to make. Therefore, the only way I can see them doing it is by saying, I hate having to do this, but we're being forced to do it. I don't see, for example, how any Israeli prime minister is going to be able to withdraw the settlements from the West Bank. The hothouse atmosphere of Israeli politics makes that almost inconceivable. Is it possible for Palestinian leaders to say, we're starting recognizing Israel, starting tomorrow, we're going to trade with them? It's going to be very difficult. Nonetheless, since we know where this is all going, I think that the U.S., with cooperation from other countries, and with all the resources that the U.S. has to exert pressure in that part of the world, if we decide to use them, could force those countries to make concessions that they're not willing to make in any other way. Now, your question was, how politically feasible is that? It's probably not. But that's my role. I didn't get elected to anything. I will say this. I gave a speech in Washington just a few days ago, and a guy came up to me who was is a member of the White House, or let's say very close with the White House National Security team. And he said to me, our group would agree with you on one thing, which is that the policies we've been working with up to now are not working. We need something new. We've got to conceive of something big. But, and this is almost a direct quote from what he said to me, we haven't figured out what that new big policy would be, nor have we figured out how to bring the electorate along with us. This, I think, is the big challenge. And the argument that I would use in trying to persuade the American electorate is, this is good for us. This is not a giveaway. Negotiation is not like Munich every time. It's not something that we are sacrificing. We're looking for our own long-term interests. And responding to the emotion of the day is ultimately going to make the world much more dangerous for our grandchildren. So let's do this for them.
Another question is, again, back to Mossadegh era. What are your thoughts to the alternative of the U.S. and U.K. not having thrown the 1953 coup d'etat? Would Mossadegh have been aligned more to the communists? He did have socialistic mentality. Would he have become a communist?
Now that I've become a university professor, which is why some people start to call me doctor, I've been told that we're not supposed to answer questions like this. They're called counterfactual, and professors do not deal in counterfactuals. However, I'm not a real professor. I'm just a journalist, so I can do that. I don't lose my membership card in the professional political scientist fraternity. I actually don't believe that Mossadegh was sympathetic to Marxism or socialism at all. He was an elderly aristocrat and very much a defender of tradition. In many ways, he was a conservative, even though he was a nationalist. What would have happened if Mossadegh had not been overthrown? Don't forget that Stalin had tried to occupy a part of northern Iran after World War II. But under diplomatic pressure, he withdrew. It was the only neighboring country to the Soviet Union from which Stalin ever voluntarily withdrew troops. I think that maybe he had come to an understanding that Iran was not his priority. His real priority was Eastern Europe. Of course, Stalin died immediately after the Mossadegh coup, so that situation changed. The Tudeh Party, the Communist Party in Iran was relatively weak. It's very difficult to say who would have tried to take advantage of this, but I really do think there is a chance that we could have had this real democracy in the Middle East for 50 years and try to think what that example would have meant. Now, let me just finish by adding one other little story about the results of the Mossadegh coup. A few months ago, to my surprise, I received an invitation to come to New York and join a dinner for President Ahmadinejad. So, sure enough, my dinner with it was not Fessenjan, unfortunately, but I had my dinner with Mahmoud. There were about 50 other people there. It wasn't just the president and I. Nonetheless, it was a very interesting evening, and it was, of course, fascinating to watch him and get some kind of a personal opinion of him. So he asked everybody in the room to ask a question. And there were about 50 people in the room, so it took like an hour and a half before everybody got to ask their question before he even started answering them. But when it came to me, my idea was, I don't want to ask a question like everybody else. As you can see from what I've said tonight, I don't like to try to repeat what other people are saying and thinking. Most of the questions were on two subjects. One was the nuclear issue, and the other was the repression of the protests that followed last year's election. So I wanted to ask something that didn't have to do with either of those. And sure enough, when my turn came, I said, Mr. President, many of us in America have heard of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh and the story of what happened to him. What is your view of Mossadegh and the coup that overthrew him? I want to flatter myself and say, although I have no evidence at all that this is true, that this was the first time Ahmadinejad had ever been asked about Mossadegh in public. It's possible, and until someone contradicts me, I'm going to continue believing that. He had a fascinating answer. It was very short, and I think I can quote it almost verbatim. He said, Dr. Mossadegh was a popular leader who unfortunately was overthrown. But we don't want to think too much about that episode, because if we do, we will never want to talk to the United States.
Interesting, very interesting. All right, moving on to next question. How close is Iran to having the bomb, and will they use it if they had one?
Iran is too close to getting a nuclear bomb. I don't think it's going to happen anytime this month or this year or next year. But from what I read, written by people that know a lot more about this subject than I do, one of whom is sitting right here on the podium, that project is proceeding apace. And if nothing happens, ultimately, although we are working very hard covertly as well as overtly to disrupt it, it's going to reach its goal. History shows, including the history of the Israeli nuclear program and the South African nuclear program that, and Pakistani one and Indian one, that when countries get close to the finish line on the nuclear project, then it's very hard to dissuade them. They'll do almost anything to cross over. Now, I think that there is still hope for the U.S., as I said earlier, to try to persuade Iranians to take a different course. But we have to open up our negotiating posture and try to make a deal that the Iranians are willing to accept, a deal that we might accept if we were in their shoes, and not try to make a deal that is only good for us and bad for them, because they're not going to accept that. Now, the second part of your question in some ways even more interesting. Would they use it? You know, nuclear weapons essentially lose most of their utility once you use them. It's, you know, people that are trained in how to torture are always told, don't kill the guy, okay? Then you're finished. Then you have nothing left. I was in Israel doing research for this book, Reset. I was at a conference about Iran. After the conference, the participants were taken to a private meeting in which we were given a private speech by one of the top leaders of the Israeli government. And he explained, how does Israel see the world and see Iran? He said something very, very interesting about Iran's nuclear program. He said, look, you're reading in your newspapers that we Israelis are terrified of Iran getting a nuclear bomb because we're afraid that if they get the nuclear bomb, they're going to bomb us. He said, actually, that's half true. We really don't like the idea of Israel getting a nuclear bomb, but we don't think they would ever bomb us. We don't contradict that view because it sounds logical to lots of people, but it's not true. Nobody in our security establishment really believes that Iran would ever do something so stupid as to drop a nuclear bomb on Israel, because Iran would be totally liquidated as a nation within an hour. And they realize that. And they are not crazy. They don't want that. So we know they're not going to bomb us. However, we are afraid of Iran's nuclear weapons capability for two other reasons. One is, when you have a nuclear weapon, you're able to push people around. You're able to intimidate people. And, of course, they should know. Secondly, we Israelis are afraid, that a nuclear bomb for Iran would lead to an arms race in the neighborhood. Maybe Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Egypt would also want nuclear weapons, and then we'd all be in trouble. I would add a third reason that he didn't give. When you have nuclear weapons and you're the only country in the neighborhood that has them, you have almost total freedom to use force as you wish. When another country that's a rival is also nuclear armed, your freedom to use your conventional power is constrained. I think the Israelis are very aware of that, and for that reason, too, are eager to try to retard this program.
Okay. For the benefit of our radio program audience, you're listening to Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our guest today is Stephen Kinzer, author and former New York Times foreign correspondent, who is discussing Iran and its relationship with the U.S. Stephen, we have a number of additional questions, so moving on. You talked about 21st century being the middle power, the century of middle power, such as we saw with Brazil and Turkey supporting Iran when the sanction time came. It seems to me, and I'm asking, this is my question, having been a former academic, I know how it is to make decision by a committee. You get some watered-down version, which results in minimal change. So how would your middle power era work?
Actually, I think it is an answer to this dilemma. You don't have to deal with clubs that don't work, like the United Nations or the European Union, where you have this consensus or large majority requirement. Essentially, you just have countries that have nominated themselves because of their levels of political and economic power in their region. Brazil and Turkey, for example, are not part of some large organization that met and then decided two of our members will go off and negotiate with Iran. Brazil and Turkey decided this on their own. We now have smaller groups like this, the P5 plus one. We have the G20. I imagine a very informal group of countries, not working as a coherent alliance, but sharing the idea of multipolarity. I don't think it's so much the idea that all these countries are going to agree on a particular set of policies. But what they are going to agree on is how policies in the world should be set. That big countries in each region should have a say in what's going on in their region. And that one or two powers running the world is not going to work. Now, we had the opposite situation, where it was essentially just the U.S. or just the U.S. and the Soviets essentially deciding what's going to happen everywhere in the world. That kind of a division of labor is not going to emerge again in the new century. You can argue about whether it's better or worse that way. But whichever way is better, the fact is that at least the relative power of the United States is declining. And if the U.S. is clever, it can still hold on to most of its power. But in order to do that, it has to readjust to new realities. If it refuses to do that and continues to try to act as though it can do whatever it wants in the world, then it risks a big crash.
Mm-hmm. This question is a two-part question. And perhaps it's most relevant because you had an opportunity to travel to Iran recently and see things firsthand after the 2009 mini revolution or street protest. Two questions. Part one, was the so-called Green Revolution, or is the Green Revolution stalled temporarily, or was it a stillborn child to begin with? The second part is, how did the shooting of Nida change the course of this uprising?
I would say that the green movement is definitely not stillborn, but as I said earlier, the people who were involved in those protests made a very rational decision. You know, life is reasonably good for most people in Iran. The fact that an election might have been stolen is not enough to force every Iranian out of their homes onto the streets to face people with guns. They've made a pragmatic decision that life here is not so awful that I want to sacrifice myself and my security and my family. It's not that bad. I actually believe that the ideals of the Green Movement are very potent. Think of this statistic, which I always have trouble assimilating. 70% of the people of Iran are under 30. That means they were born after the revolution. They have no memory of the Shah. We're going to get the result that we want in Iran. We just have to be patient and let Iranians do it. You know, lately, we've been getting a lot of pressure in the U.S., and there have been a series of articles in these Beltway magazines saying that the U.S. should stand up and make clear that we totally support the Green Movement, that we totally support change in Iran. Anybody who goes out in the streets in Iran is our friend. We back you. We're enthusiastic. We encourage you, and we'll do anything we can to support you. This is a terrible idea. There is nothing that will delegitimize that movement faster, particularly in a country with such a long and painful tradition of foreign intervention, than having some big power from thousands of miles away say, oh, that's our movement. We love them. The people in that movement don't want that. I think if they were to say to us, don't negotiate with our leaders, isolate them, then I think we might have to listen to them. But they're not telling us that. They're telling us the opposite. The reform movement in Iran is in a difficult position. It doesn't have any good options right now. The best of the bad options is that the regime would somehow be coaxed out of its repressive isolation and calmed down. That's what they want us to do. Nobody in Iran would like to see us more actively involved in promoting that movement. That is Iran. That's Iran's business, and it's going to proceed at Iran's pace. As far as the shooting of Neda, you know, I do think that that was one of a number of violent episodes that led many Iranians to realize we're not going to achieve our goal this way. It's not going to work. It's time to pull back and think about the future in a longer-term way. Nonetheless, I'm not sure it had such a dramatic impact in Iran as it did in the United States. In Iran, it was placed against the backdrop of everything else that was happening. It was one episode. But here, it had a particularly riveting, almost kind of orientalist appeal of this very beautiful young woman kind of bleeding to death in front of you. And she was just the kind of woman that most of us would identify with as a daughter or a sister. I'm not so sure that it had the emotional resonance that we built it up to have over here. Mm-hmm. Here it was thought of as the one crystallizing incident, the Great Boston Tea Party or the Bastille Raid. In Iran, it was part of a very unfortunate series of episodes that led people to, I think, a very sober decision about their futures.
Question back to relations between Iran and Israel. Stephen, do you think Iran will challenge Israel's blockade of Gaza? And do you foresee any circumstance where Israel and Iran can have and achieve détente?
I hope that Iran does not get involved in challenging the Gaza blockade. That situation, that confrontation has been ratcheted up too high already. Everybody gets the point now, and I think the people who organized that flotilla have succeeded beyond their wildest dreams in focusing world attention on Gaza and actually producing some improvement in the situation there. So now's the time to ratchet down the confrontation. I think everybody understands the realities there. There's no need to beat world opinion over the head anymore. What's needed now is some way forward. Now, you asked about Iran and Israel in the future. Actually, Turkey fits into this equation also. Turks and Iranians traditionally have been great friends of Jews. Jews flooded into the Ottoman Empire for hundreds of years. When they were thrown out of Spain, when they were thrown out of Bavaria, when they were subject to pogroms in Poland and Ukraine, they came to the Ottoman Empire. By 1800, most of the Jews in the world were living in the Ottoman Empire. Persians and Jews also have a very warm relationship. Cyrus, the great emperor of Iran, was the one who freed the Jews from their Babylonian captivity. He is praised in the Bible. So the relationship between Turks and Jews and between Iranians and Jews is very, very old. Under the Islamic Republic, of course, because the regime has been very anti-Israel, you haven't seen that relationship flower. In fact, it's atrophied. Nonetheless, I can tell you that Iranians are not as emotionally invested in the Arab-Israeli conflict as other Arabs are. Yeah, they sympathize with the Palestinians, but it's not as big an emotional issue for Iranians as it is for Arabs. I'd also say that many Iranians harbor, privately and personally, great admiration for Jews, for the Jewish culture. They feel that Jews, many of them have told me, Jews are like us. This is a very old culture. They're civilized. They prize education. They prize learning. And behind all this is a feeling that's, how could I put it in a politically correct way? Let's say that they're both Jews and Turks and Iranians have a love for Arabs that is limited. Would that be a nice way to put it?
Politically correct.
There is the basis, I think, when the political overlay is stripped away for a good relationship between Iran and Israel and between Turkey and Israel, actually much more potential than there is between the Arab countries and Israel. These countries can be the bridge for Israel to get out of its isolation, Turkey in particular. And I do believe that over the long run, if we look over the course of the coming century, prospects for Iran-Israel friendship are not far-fetched at all. It just requires a change in mentality on both sides. Nothing more than that.
Many Iranian Americans have a deep appreciation for your work ever since you wrote All the Shah's Men, describing in an objective way what actually happened in Iran and the role that America played. Now, can you tell us what motivates most American media not to have openly discuss that? Why is it that very few Americans know about this outside of those who've written your books?
Well, it's wonderful to hear that Iranian Americans have appreciated my efforts to get to know their country and to tell their country's story. It's a wonderful fringe benefit, I can tell you, to get interested in a country that has wonderful cuisine. I have been invited into many Turkish homes and many Iranian homes, and I think whatever country I pick next, I'm thinking maybe could there be a political crisis in Indonesia I could write about? I like Indonesian food. So it's been a wonderful relationship for me to have built with the Iranian-American community. Why is it that this episode, the American overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953, which had such a profound effect, not just on Iran, but on the United States and on the whole world, is so little known? First of all, of course, at the beginning it was a covert operation, and it wasn't until decades later that information of it about it sort of began to dribble out. But I also think there's a larger reason. Sometimes I ask myself why the United States has such a huge, deep, and abiding fascination, really to the point of obsession, with our experience in World War II. If you were to take all the books that have been written in the U.S. about World War II and put them together, they might, I don't know, they probably stretch around the whole world at the equator. Yeah. It never ends. And it's the war in the Pacific, and then it's the D-Day invasion, and it's over and over. Nobody would deny that World War II was a hugely important event. Nonetheless, I think there's another reason why it occupies such a central place in our national consciousness, and it is that World War II and the history of that war shows us to be the way we imagine ourselves to be. We fought tyranny, and we brought democracy. That's what we like to think that we do. Therefore, we want to focus forever on that episode. In fact, that was the exception. In many cases, like Iran, the United States went into countries that were democratic. We overthrew regimes that were led by people who supported what we would call basic American principles, and we replaced them with tyrants who despise everything the United States stands for. Now, telling this story over and over again doesn't conform to our image of ourselves. That's why I think if you look at any history of the 20th century, you'd be lucky to find one line about Mossadegh or the 1953 coup in Iran. It's considered a very insignificant episode. And I think the reason is that it doesn't show the West, and particularly the United States, in the light that most of us want to see it. We all want to think well of ourselves. It works for countries just like for individuals. And I think about myself the same way that America as a unit thinks about itself. I feel, for example, that I'm a really nice guy. If you got to know me, you would really like me. And if you don't like me, there's only two possible explanations. One is that you don't know me. You haven't really realized what a good person I am, or you have some misconceptions. The other one is that you're a bad person yourself. You're a jerk. So you wouldn't like a nice person like me. That's exactly the way the U.S. presents itself to the world, and other countries do the same thing. I think our general belief is that if there is a regime or a person or a faction or a country or a leader who is anti-American, there's two explanations. Number one is he doesn't know the story. He just doesn't get who we are and how good we are. Or number two, he's evil. They're bad and they hate everything that's good. The idea that there could be some force or person out there who really understands what America is and what America does, who's anti-American, is something that we can't conceive. And that's one reason why I think we love to read about World War II more than we like to read about the 1953 coup in Iran.
It's been a fascinating discussion. Unfortunately, we have come at a time to a point where we need to wrap up. Our thanks to Stephen Kinzer, former New York Times foreign correspondent and author of the new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and on the Internet. I'm Jale Dai, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.